Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes naturalist Gabriel Tallent to discuss his debut novel, My Absolute Darling, the story of a young girl's quest for redemption. Wednesday, June 27th at 7 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.
I'm Dan Rodericks of the Baltimore Sun, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 402 for June 21st, 2018. On the show today, writer and editor Darnell Moore with commentary on a wide range of topics: Donald J. Trump, the Trumpian horror at the U.S. border with Mexico, bigotry and the Bible, Black Lives Matter, and coming of age, black and gay. Darnell Moore has written a memoir about growing up black and gay, finding his identity and his voice. And while he joins us, we'll get his comments on the big story of the moment, the Trump administration's separating of immigrant children from their parents in an effort to stop border crossings by families from Mexico and Central America. Before we get to Darnell Moore and his book, here's critic Paula Gallagher with this week's recommendation.
Dan, this week's book is The High Season by Judy Blundell, and this is my top pick for a beach read. So allow yourself to be transported to a hamlet on the North Fork of Long Island, a place where the locals recede to make way for the moneyed vacationers, welcoming them to a getaway spot that has been referred to as the Anti-Hamptons. Local museum director Ruthie Beamish kicks off the high season with a high-profile fundraiser, even as she's vacating her year-round home to live in a glorified garden shed so that she can earn some big money renting her home to a member of the upper class. And this year's renter, it's the very wealthy widow of Peter Clay, the notorious factory system artist who Ruthie once worked for. And this widow quickly turns her sights on Mike, Ruthie's ex-husband, the one she never managed to divorce. This juicy novel is populated with both relatable, three-dimensional characters and its social satire, a skewering of the upper class, the backbiting women of the local museum board, the lifestyles of the rich and famous in certain circles, and the aspire-to-bes. And it's a commentary on the art world. It's relationships in all their forms, from romantic to business to familial, all played out during the high season of social events, farm stands, and summer sun. This is Blundell's first novel for adults. She's an accomplished and prolific author of both children's and young adult books. And when I heard she had an adult novel coming, I was very excited. It was akin to when Judy Blum announced that she had an adult novel and wrote several of those. I was thrilled to find a juicy, more literary summer read that doesn't require to check your brain at the cabana. Again, this is The High Season by Judy Blundell.
Paula Gallagher is a librarian in the Baltimore County system. She joins us once a week to recommend a good read here on Roughly Speaking.
Hi, I'm Quinn Kelly, and I host a weekly podcast for the Baltimore Sun called Female Trouble. Each Tuesday, we feature a new long-form conversation with one of the area's most interesting and accomplished women, from public officials and congresswomen to rappers and restaurant owners. You can find Female Trouble on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Find more info at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble.
Now to our guest, Darnell Moore, writer, leader of Black Lives Matter, and author of No Ashes in the Fire, Coming of Age, Black and Free in America. This memoir, Moore says, is meant to pass along life lessons, particularly to boys who grow up in cities like Baltimore or Moore's hometown, Camden, New Jersey. And more than that, boys who come of age and come out gay, who are bullied, who face depression and other emotional challenges on the way to self-discovery. It's hard not to think about what's going on at the U.S. border. I was wondering what your thoughts are on it in the context of your memoir, reflecting on your own childhood and the pain of that childhood. You speak in the book about pain inflicted by people and institutions on all kinds of people. You know, here it is directed at immigrants who Trump, portrays as criminals.
I really try to expose what I call the invisible or unseen hands, right? Like that do the work behind the scenes in the lives of young people. But here's the thing, some of those hands aren't invisible. And by hands, it was a metaphor for the state, for state institutions, for school systems and religious institutions whose policies or actions impact the lives and well-being of young people, particularly young people who are already vulnerable, who already exist on what I say the edges of the margins. And this is what is happening right now, except the hands are not invisible. They are seen. We know that the Trump administration has been in the works of enacting these harmful policies for some time. And even though there are folk who are sort of loud about our disapproval of these policies, there are some people in this country who actually support it. In the book, I talk about how theology can be used to manipulate the senses and to shape laws and to shape practices and our responses to people in ways that are harmful. So I typically differentiate theologies that kill from theologies that heal. And what we've seen over the last few weeks is some within the administration using the Bible to condone practices of separating children from their families, immigrant children from their families, as if the Bible is in fact in support of that. And we know that it isn't. I mean, the way that the stories that have been lifted up have been sort of stripped of meaning and reinterpreted, misinterpreted to support the dangerous policies on the part of this administration is just, it's anathema to me. It's overwhelmingly disgusting. So here we have folk on the sort of Christian right who have been using Bible to support an executive branch policy that is ripping apart families, that will cause psychological harm and trauma to young people and their parents, that will inevitably, you know, mark a significant point in their lives. And that seems so far away from the gospel, if one is to believe in that, than ever before. I mean, Brittany Cooper, who is a writer whose book Eloquent Rage is just recently released, she said, you know, Jeff Sessions' God is not mine. Like, that the God of white supremacy, a God of xenophobia, a God that is interested in, you know, using harm as a tool for its governance is not a God that I serve. So I want to name that. The other is just the ways that so much of the traumas of our youth, what we experience in our lives as young people, whether that's at the hands of parents or at the hands of the state and educational institutions, will inevitably have an impact on those young people moving forward. And I think that's just important to note. And that's one of the things I try to underscore in the book.
A reader of my column in The Sun had an interesting comment on Facebook that I wanted to share with you.
Sure.
He writes, this is a guy named Chris Blake. So, Dan, given your newfound grave concerns for children of color being separated from their families, I don't know where he gets the newfound thing, but whatever. Are you ready to stand up and speak out in support of closing such a facility right here in Baltimore, the Juvenile Detention Center? And he provided a photograph of our still fairly new Juvenile Detention Center.
Sure.
Let me see you repeat after me. Free all of the children overwhelmingly black in this facility and reunite them with their families and redirect those resources to direct family aid and counseling. You can do it, but only if you are serious about the issue and not just playing politics. Well, okay. First, I thought it was a little tangential, a bit of apples and oranges to what's going on. But there is a movement in the United States, a big push.
Yeah.
To treat juveniles very differently than we have in the past, to get them out of, you know, adult facilities, number one. Even the Supreme Court has made some rulings about that. But this idea about how we treat children, or that we don't even look at children as children,
yeah,
says a lot about, and not anything good about our society.
I mean, two things that I think is important to note. One, you just brought up a point about not seeing children as children, and I want to be even more specific. Children of color are not often allowed the space or the sort of, you don't see children as children. They're not allowed to be children. That's why, you know, you have young children of color who are asked to be, even if, when they're 8 and 9, they're already being pushed to be the better man or woman. It's why you can have a 12-year-old playing in a park with his sister, like Tamir Rice, you know, and be seen as an adult who has the potential to do harm and then be shot to death by law enforcement. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are scholars who talk about young black children specifically as having what they call accelerated childhoods. That is, not the opportunity to be children in a way that white children can be, to make mistakes, to do juvenile and acts that can sort of easily be forgiven, to be understood as not yet adult. Like, those are not type of gifts that are easy, that are readily available to young people who are of color. The second thing I would say that I hear in that comment is a larger question about the usefulness of carceral institutions, prisons and jails, as molds for transformation. And one of the areas that was a policy area that was present in the movement for Black Lives over the last several years, it wasn't just about police abuse and calling that out, but also about a reevaluation of the way that within this country, prisons have been seen and used as tools for quote-unquote rehabilitation and transformation. But to what end? To what end are they being transformative and rehabilitatory when, in fact, the crux of the policies that lead people to prisons and jails tend to have been so misguided and so shaped by sort of racial ideology that the prisons and jails are behemoths that are filled with the bodies of black and brown people. We know this to be true in places like New York, where stop and frisk has been deemed unconstitutional. So we know that all the black and brown folk in the jail aren't there primarily because of something they did wrong, but because of the way that they looked, right? That said, I think a larger question that we as a society have to ask is, what is transformative justice look like? What is the route to transformative justice? You know, I have a father who's been in and out of jails. If jails were what were to make him better, then why every time he came back out, he seemed to be worse, right? The responsibility doesn't fall necessarily on the state to make one better, but we also be thinking outside of that. So I think the question is, right now we should be thinking about alternative means beyond retribution and punishment, which often looks like jails and prisons, as a form of rehabilitation, as a form of atonement, as a form of transformation, when in fact, I don't think that they're doing much of any of that.
Let's put the corrections back in corrections. You know, which is,
exactly.
You know, it's the idea of using that time when someone is incarcerated to help change their lives, to really be transforming.
And dreaming even bigger. Yeah. What could we put in place of some of these institutions to do the work that we think that the institution should be doing? And I think that work is the radical work of imagining something new and something different that we haven't been exposed to yet, right?
Right, that's right.
So in some ways, I applaud what the critic is asking of us to do there and to think about that.
I just wanted to ask you a question about Trump's America, an observation I had, and your book made me think about this some more. Your book is an eye-opener, and I think it would be for anybody who cares to learn what it was like for you to grow up being the person you are, becoming the person you are.
Sure. Sure.
And that is that I think on the good side of this, all this ugliness we've seen in the last few years with this president, and even before that, I think with Black Lives Matter, is eyes being opened to something that wasn't seen before with the help of cell phone cameras showing us things that a lot of white people just didn't believe was true before about police and the mm-hmm. way they spoke to black people, the way they handled black suspects. You know, in some respects, I think there's a good thing going on in the country where people are more aware of what others go through. Now, there's a lot of harsh reality on the other side. There's a lot of bigotry still that's come out with Trump that's been empowered by Trump. But on the good side, I think people seem to be more aware of what others are going through, especially white people. Maybe not enough of them, but that's certainly something I notice and sense.
So I don't want it to not do the work of attending to history and act as if this moment that we're in is not very particular and specific, mm-hmm. that Trump's ascension to the presidency is somehow, you know, not significant in the history of politics within this country. However, I'm not surprised at Trump's ascendancy. Trump came to power after 8 years of Barack Obama, who had been both called the nation's sort of first black president, and also have been caricatured as an ape, literally in some spaces across media. So race, you know, that the sort of white rage or white response to a Democrat centrist progressive leaning president who was also black was to be expected. That's just sort of how the pendulum swings. But what was interesting to me are two things. One, that for those who know how the reality of a white rage, of the sort of white nationalist impulses, of xenophobia, of rabid antagonism towards queer and trans people, a pillaging of poor communities, these types of outright displays are not new. They're not new. The people who are, you know, impacted by those ideas are not necessarily surprised. What was interesting to me, to your point, was the sort of surprise of those for whom this was for the first time made obvious, which points to a problem to me, which says that so many of us, and let me be clear, that so many people for whom those had not been issues, whether they be white folk, whether they who happen to not be gay or lesbian or bisexual, trans, I mean, you know, I can go down the line here, but for whoever for those who haven't been touched by that issue, it's like you're allowed to sort of live within the comfort and relative safety of ignorance,
right?
And to go about the day as if nothing. But as soon as sort of like these things get close to home, it's like all of a sudden, woe is us. Look at what we're facing, and I'm sitting back like, what? This isn't, you know, this is not new.
Yeah, but I know, Darnell, but you know what it's like. I mentioned the cell phone cameras. To me, that was an important moment the last 2 years. Like, we didn't believe the narrative, we didn't believe the oral history, the oral testimony. But once we saw a video, then more people started to believe.
But you know, but part of that is like that shit. I want to be in a community where we should not even have to get those videos replayed over and over and over again, mm-hmm. to the dismay many of the folk who have to see themselves being pillaged and hurt a lot of times, for us to believe. That's the point that I'm trying to get to, right? That in so many ways, empathy should not have to come by virtue of a type of witness that says, now I see it with my eyes, rather than having heard a witness. And then these accounts are not new. We've been saying this for four. How many years have we?
That's my point.
Like,
yeah.
So there's that. But the other thing I want to say, too, is it didn't just embolden a type of racism. It revealed the racism that always exists and gave. And what I agree with is that it emboldened those who might have otherwise at their kitchen table,
right,
or to their close friends,
right,
or within the black space of the Internet or behind avatars. It emboldened them to be outright with what they did. It didn't mean that these were new racists or new white nationalists or new xenophobes. No, they've been doing this. I think a lot of them now found a rationale to say this stuff out loud, and that was the thing that to me was not even bothersome, but just like, okay, we have a president whom has given sort of credence to these things, and actually, to use your word, have emboldened them to come out of the quote unquote proverbial closet, and that's the damning thing, if not shocking.
Darnell, also one thing about Trump that probably strikes a personal chord for you is the bully. Bullies have particular meaning for you when you examined your life in this memoir.
Absolutely. You know, I talk a lot about sort of how masculinity has been shaped such that we think that to be real, quote-unquote, strong men is to be always the powerful, always in control, always manipulating that power and control, often to the detriment of other people. And I've had my fair share of being bullied. I also talk about moments when I found myself on the position of the bully as well. And one of the things that I think with Trump is interesting is that, you know, he is the ultimate sort of like symbol of the sort of white masculinist. And in so many ways, when even though it looks like a farce, and something, you know, this sort of like performance that we should all laugh at and call him out on, it certainly has attracted a large percentage of folk in this country, which tells me that we so many of us, and let me be clear, I don't want to say so many of us, because I need to be more specific. You know, this man was voted in by a majoritarian group of a white bloc, not just men, but women. And that white masculinist sort of trope, that idea, is something that these folk apparently love and think is the sort of rule of the day, right? And not only do I talk about bullies, but I talk about our need to really interrogate and name the problem that is sort of these masculine ideas grounded in sexism and patriarchy and misogyny, which is clearly a lot of that which we've seen Trump display. That you have people who are deeply attracted to that and see that as a sort of epitome of what it means to be powerful is highly problematic. Highly problematic. You know, part of me want to believe that in 2018 we have we've emerged as a different type of people, that we've come to sort of challenge our ideas about what manhood is, about what a good leader is, and we have Trump in the White House.
Yeah, I know. The world is upside down.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Hey, speaking of that experience with bullies that was very real for you in Camden, New Jersey, the title of your book, No Ashes in the Fire, I was curious, our listeners may be wondering what that title means. It's poetic.
Yes, it references, it's a poetic sort of title, and it's a metaphor referencing a moment when I was 14 years old. And, you know, speaking of manhood and boyhood, I wasn't like seen as the typical boy, typical man. I danced and sang and played with the girls and was picked on a lot because of my gender presentation. I wasn't quote unquote hard. The boys read me as soft and called me names that, you know, derogatory names in response to that. And I often found different routes to get home from school. I was very creative in that way because I knew that if I went down certain streets, that it was potential for harm was present. But this one day, these boys tried to jump me. They physically attacked me, neighbors of mine, about four of them. And during the process, one of them took a gallon of gasoline and emptied it on me. And then tried to light a match, but the match wouldn't light. It was sort of a windy day, or at least the wind kept knocking the flame out. So that title is a reference to survival. It, you know, there was no fire that day, so there was no body to be laid, and it could have been, right? So there were no ashes present in the fire. And in so many ways, like, it was my way of signifying survival, but also being very real that for black people in the America who have experienced, who have been brought here, you know, so for African Americans, folk who are here as descendants of the enslaved, America, or at least the America that we love to talk about and or rather lie about, has always been on fire with regards to our lives. And yet we survive, some of us. Not all of us did or do. We build family. We create lives. We figure out a way to make joy. We figure out a way to sort of give back to our communities. Sometimes fail. And not get up, sometimes get back up in the midst of the fire, so that survival is present. And what I wanted to do was to say that even though these fires are present, and yes, some of us survive through that, which is a commentary on black life, it's still a critique that there are still forces out here setting fire to lives, whether that's the lives of LGBTQ folk and kids, people who don't sort of fit the gender sort of restrictive ideas that we have about gender, to girls and women, like, the, you know, fires are set, some people survive and some don't, and that was my way of speaking to that in the book.
And who are you speaking to?
My audience, the audience in my head was very specific, and I was writing to, like, and I imagined that a theater, and in it was sitting, like, this little, skinny, scrawny, quirky black boy with glasses. and I kept imagining, like, a 16-year-old version of me. And that's who I was writing to. Mm-hmm. And I kept thinking, if I could write a book that I had needed when I was 16 or 14 and had access to those words, how might my life have been different over the course of two decades? Might I have spent less days trying to kill myself and take myself out of here? Might I have spent more days looking in the mirror and loving the image that was back, had someone given me some affirmative words? And what I said to someone who once said, well, because it was so specific, do you think that, like, other people can sort of find themselves in it? Not my response as an artist is that specificity isn't a narrowing of experience. It is actually, for the artist, a way of inviting people into the vastness of other ways of being. I actually think that a lot of people will read the book regardless, whether they grew up, even if they didn't grow up in Camden, even if they're not black, even if they're not gay identified or queer or LGBT or grew up without wealth and see semblances of human experiences in it. But that can only happen, though, because I think I honored the sort of specific call to write to this young black boy sitting in the room that I thought I needed to write to. Doesn't mean it will disclose any other experiences. I actually think it's replete with a bunch of things that folk will be able to relate to. But that's specifically who I was writing to and why.
You know, that's an important mission. A lot of people, when they become adults or have kids of their own or are around children, they think they're influencing them by, I don't know, example. I don't know. How many actually take the time to pass along the lessons they've learned as they were growing up?
Yeah.
I mean, do people really do it? I think some people do. Parents try, maybe. I think people think they do a lot more of it than they actually do. So there's the importance of your book. Now, before I let you go, do you have No Ashes in the Fire with you?
I do.
Well, what's your favorite? Do you have a favorite passage to read?
So this is from a chapter called Unbecoming.
Yeah, it's a good chapter.
And I'll read this because I think it was a way for me to examine, like, the role of masculinity in my life. So I say here that black girls are expected to mother black boys who are and aren't their sons. And black boys, queer or straight, often demand our mothers, sisters, friends, and partners meet and even exceed that expectation. All boys are taught that the world is theirs, but black boys learn early on that the world they are required to rule is the home, the place often sustained by the visible and invisible labor of black women and girls we share homes and relationships with. The home is likened to a kingdom black boys are expected to provide for, fight to protect, and lord over. Outside the home, the streets black boys navigate are controlled by the state and the wealthy, and black boys' freedoms are restricted and policed. And this is the part I really wanted to get to. White boys are raised to rule the home, the streets, the banks, the courts, the legislative halls, the church, the academy, the medical industry, the military, and the country. They are granted permission to travel through the world, never questioning their need to control others' bodies and properties, never reflecting on their incessant demand for respect and entitlement, never removing themselves from the center of the public imagination. Black boys are taught to replicate the white boy game, but eventually they realize the game was never set in their favor. Some then do all they can to manipulate the contest by trying to beat the game masters in a match best forfeited. If the country cannot be ruled, the home damn sure can, which include attempts at ruling the lives and bodies of our mothers, sisters, partners, nieces, and aunties. I played the game over and over again and have wounded black girls and women. I wounded myself not realizing that patriarchy, male dominance, takes aims at girls and women and a humanity of men too. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that's a very good chapter, too. I'm glad you went to Unbecoming.
It just fit like when we were talking.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking about when we were talking, you know, about Trump and all of the folk who are Trump's minions.
Well, they don't get it, but I think a lot of people do. More and more people do. And I think more people are focused now because Trump is in the White House.
Yeah.
Anyway, mm-hmm. Darnell, it's been a pleasure to speak with you. And thank you so much. Yeah, thank you very much for your work.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And thanks for taking the time to talk. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Darnell Moore, editor-at-large at Cassius, is a writer in residence at the Center of African American Religion, Sexual Politics, and Social Justice at Columbia University. His book, published by Nation Books, is No Ashes in the Fire, Coming of Age, Black and Free in America. That's my show for now. We'll be back next week with coverage of Tuesday's primary election in Maryland. Members of the Sun staff will be joining me for shows on Monday and Wednesday. Your thoughts are welcome by email, Twitter, or on Facebook. Please tell your friends about Roughly Speaking if you get a chance. For producer Quinn Kelly in the Baltimore Sun newsroom, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks, as always, for listening, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent, locally owned bookseller. The shop offers the best in literature, current affairs, history, poetry, and, of course, books about Baltimore. The Ivy is located at Falls Road at Lake Avenue in Mount Washington. Check it out at theivybookshop.com.